previously on Beta.
He won't shut up about Door County. He's in love with Door County.
People are selling imaginary friends on eBay, and I'm going to buy one.
Oh. Jeez.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Wisconsin-born comedian Jackie Cation reflects on over 3.5 decades of finding the funny.
In the last album, I think it was, I did a joke about how my father was a lot like radiation. We never saw him, but he affected all of our lives.
Also, journalist James Andrew Miller on HBO's 50-year history. He shares how HBO's creative risks turned them from a simple pay channel into a talent destination.
And so HBO wound up being an important place for these comedians, and in turn, something that the audience couldn't get anywhere else.
But first, Charlie Behrens. You might remember him as an Emmy Award-winning journalist, but that was a while ago, so we understand if you don't. Chances are that you probably know Charlie as a comedian and the man behind the online comedy series, The Manitowoc Minute. His Midwest-centric videos have received millions of views. Well, son of a gun, now Charlie is a New York Times best-selling author, don't you know? His first book is called The Midwest Survival Guide, How We Talk, Love, Work, Drink, and Eat Everything with Ranch. Oh, jeez Louise, how did Charlie pull that off? Well, he joined us from his Milwaukee home to teach us all about being Midwest nice. But we wanted to know, what the heck is the difference between the Manitowoc Minute guy and the real Charlie Behrens?
Well, the Manitowoc Minute version is basically just an exaggerated version of who I am. And it, you know, it's based off my time in local news where people would say I did things wrong. I said things wrong. I had an accent. Bubbler is not a word you can say in Texas, and it means the same thing in Wisconsin. And so the Manitowoc Minute version is a parody of the newsman that I was, where I doubled down on all the things people said I was doing wrong. Whereas, you know, in this book, I'm kind of coming to it more from who I really am. There's a lot of stories there growing up and everything, but the heart of both the Manitowoc Minute character and kind of who I am is the same. It's that same sort of Midwest mentality, that kind of be nice first, ask questions later, more interested in how to make a proper old-fashioned than I am in talking politics.
Today we're making a brandy old-fashioned Wisconsin style. Now why am I making a brandy old-fashioned? Well, simple. I got the census in the mail, and I never fill out my census without drinking a brandy old-fashioned, okay? So first things first, you gotta have the proper tools. Buck knife, a hammer, we'll get to that later, and brandy, of course.
Can you identify a turning point along your journey where you realized that your Manitowoc Minute was going to become your very own media empire?
Oh, no. I was doing stand-up because I wasn't thrilled with my job at the time. And I did this character, which would become the Manitowoc Minute character, in the comedy clubs. And for whatever reason, I was doing this in Los Angeles, you know, at the time I was doing open mics. And I remember this one show in particular at the Comedy Store. And I said, is anybody from the Midwest? And then you see in this Los Angeles comedy club, like a quarter of the room, maybe more, had their hands up. And so, you know, and that bit always did well. No matter how much my other stand-up bombed, that would always help me recover. So I was like, oh, there's something here. So I made this video, the first video, the Manitowoc Minute.
Okay, welcome to the Manitowoc Minute. This week's episode sponsored by Bobberdown Bait Shop up there in Plover. Plover, of course, is right off 39, right before you get to Stevens Point. If you get to Stevens Point, point her back the other way. Let's get these headlines done real quick once.
And that was, I named it after a fella in that club who was talking to me. He's from Manitowoc. So I didn't think I'd do a second one. And then that first one took off. You know, I think it got 500,000 views. And that was the most, you know, traction I had gotten on a video in a long, long time. The only thing that did better was a video called If Jack Dawson Was Actually From Wisconsin, where I changed up his voice.
You ever been to Wisconsin?
Home of the Packers, Miller High Life Light, the champagne of beers.
What?
Well, they have some of the coldest winters around. Grew up there near Chippewa Falls.
I remember when I was a kid. Me and my father. We went ice fishing up there on Lake Wasota. Caught some walleyes. Ice fishing is, you know, where
I know what ice fishing is.
So it's like, okay. now I have enough proof that, this is the thing that keeps working. I'm going to keep doing this. But I never in my wildest dreams would have expected all of this to happen. And I just feel very fortunate for it.
Mm-hmm. Fortunate, but also you've earned it, you know, because you're funny, you're talented, you had the drive to pursue this and do it. So, you know, give yourself a pat on the back.
Thank you. But in typical Midwest fashion, I don't think I can do that, okay, unless, you know, I've had a few old fashions, you know. So yeah. give me a moment on that. I've only had one. It's 11 a.m.
Okay, yeah, there's still lots of time. Why does Midwest life resonate with the rest of the country?
Well, you know, I think that it's one of those areas, a lot of people from other parts of the country view it as sort of the flyover states. And I think it's been largely ignored in pop culture, or it's been viewed as just kind of bland or somewhere in the middle, you know. But I think as we've kind of explored it, and there are a lot of comedians now sort of exploring the Midwest, we see these staples of our culture that you don't often think of. Once you shine a little flashlight on them, they're like, oh, that's pretty cool. And it's everything from the way we talk to interact, you know, to deer camp, to fishing for walleyes, to, you know, just our ability to tailgate.
All right, class, welcome back to Tailgating 101. I hope everybody enjoyed the bye week. Go ahead and take your seats. Today, we're starting off with a little basic tailgate anatomy. Can anybody tell me what this is? Yes, Colleen.
A truck.
Okay, more specific?
Metal.
Less specific?
A table.
Close enough. This is what we call a tailgate. You know, the thing the class is named after?
No, tailgating, I mean, better. You know, the tailgate was invented over there in Detroit, you know, and people don't often think of that. Music and culture, I mean, Motown, you know, Prince, you know, Chicago is the epicenter of so much culture. And people don't often think of it that way. But when you do start thinking about it, it starts to make sense that the Midwest is a pretty cool place.
Mm-hmm, definitely. What do you think the rest of the world would be like if they borrowed the Midwest attitude?
Well, I think, you know, I really think the Midwest nice thing is definitely something that could be borrowed. And, you know, it's a be nice first, ask questions later kind of deal.
Excuse me, miss? Would you mind if it's not too big of an ask? Could you just, you're stepping on my foot? Kind of hurts a little. Thank you. And sorry again to ask. If I was wearing shoes, it'd be no big deal, but I'm, you know, I'm wearing sandals, so.
Really, what it does is it gives you a pause before you're immediately going to react with maybe the way you want to react, and you decide to be nice anyway. And that at least gives you a moment. And the thing is that Midwest niceness is contagious. And so, you know, hopefully that spreads. I'd say if there's anything to borrow, it would be that, especially given the world we got going today.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. I'm originally from Canada, so I like to think of myself as being Canada nice. What do you think the difference is between Midwest nice and Canada nice?
Well, you know, I have spent a little time in Canada, not a ton, so I'm not an expert on that. But I will say that we got a lot of fans from Canada because they can relate quite a bit to it. And I don't think the niceness stops at the border. But I think really what it is, if we're going to get down to it, I think the cold has a lot to do with it. It's like, hey, we're out here just trying to scrape our windshields off, you know, in a negative 3-degree morning. Everyone's been through a lot just to get to work today. So let's give them a pass, you know, and nothing's too serious. And there's this self-deprecating humor that I think permeates the culture, too, that's really, you know, it helps you laugh at some of life's toughest times.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're absolutely right about the weather. And you use the word permeates. And I think it not only permeates the culture, it permeates the... Oh, geez. Forget I was going to play off of
permeates the frost.
The permafrost. The permafrost. That's it.
Yeah, that's
permeates
it.
The permafrost. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for doing the heavy lifting there.
I saw where you were going.
Yeah, you saw. I lost sight of it. Yeah. The airbags almost popped there. So, geez, I'm lucky there. So even though we are Midwest nice, we do have our fair share of famous Midwest arguments. What are they?
Oh, yeah, no, and you can't take these for granted, but casserole versus hot dish, you know, and once you even, if you can even settle on what to call the dish, you're still not going to settle on what to put on it, tots or cornflakes or some other weird starch. You know, some folks even go frosted flakes on top, and geez, that's a whole other deal.
Today we're making a dish that some of yous will call hot dish and some of yous will call casserole, but all yous will argue over which one is right and which one's a Vikings fan. Now me, I'm one of 12 kids, okay? I was mass produced. So I grew up eating casseroles all the time. Every night was like one of them potlucks in the church basement. But I never made one myself, because this one time I was making grilled cheese and pheasant, and then the Packers were playing, so I had to go in there and watch the game, you know, and I got distracted. Anyway, long story short, the fire department came and they told me I was banned from cooking for life.
Pop versus soda. You know, what are you going to call that sweet concoction you drink? Which state looks more like the mitten, Wisconsin or Michigan? You know, these are just some of the things that, you know, keep you occupied at the Thanksgiving table.
Mm-hmm. Let me follow up, because I've got to do my job here as a journalist. Follow up. Which state, Wisconsin or Michigan, has more claim on being shaped like a mitten, in your opinion?
Definitely Wisconsin. Definitely looks more like a mitten. I mean, the only way Michigan looks more like a mitten is if you're partaking in some of the legal activities they have up there in the UP, you know? So
yes.
That's my thought. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Since our show Beta airs on Wisconsin Public Radio, we always have to be careful about the kind of language that we use. Could you give us some Midwest alternatives to cuss words that we could use for when the proverbial guano hits the fan?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can say anything. Cripes is a staple, you know, and my grandpa Bob taught me that, you know, he didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain. So he would always say cripes almighty instead of the Lord's name and almighty. Sometimes he'd screw it up and actually take the Lord's name in vain and then say all Friday. He would change the wrong word. But, you know, aside for that, you can go jeepers, cripes, jiminy crickets, some of a gun. Some of a what have you, you know, holy cats, holy smokes, fudge it to heck if you're really feeling upset about something.
yeah.
There's a whole host of words we can use in there, you bet.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think another one that is often used in movies and shows on television, or it was back in the day, was for rice cakes.
Rice cakes or cheese and rice. Or cheese and mice, you know?
Yeah, they all work. Yeah, they're perfect. Yeah. Of course, no Midwest life would be complete without a Midwest bucket list. What are the top five things that our listeners should include on their Midwest bucket list?
Oh, my. You know, I don't even know if I was ready to give you a top five, but I'd be happy to try. First and foremost, you got to go ice fishing. Okay, you got to go ice fishing. Now, if you're going to drive your car out on the ice, I legally have to tell you don't. But if you do, no seat belts, okay? Out on the roads, it's click it or ticket. On the ice, it's click it and sink with it, okay? Also, Lake Michigan's got a lot of cool sunken ships, you know? And so some of the best scuba diving in the world is on Lake Michigan. Same thing, you might not think about it. Sheboygan is the Malibu of the Midwest. Great waves. You can surf the Midwest. You got to have a three-way in Cincinnati. And, you know, you might think that sounds a little goofy, but it's obviously, if you're from Cincinnati, just chilly, not something frisky. Also, you got to play euchre and play some bar dice.
All we're focusing on right now is dice. Why? Because there's shots on the line. Now, in a standard game of bar dice, you're playing against the bartender and anyone else at the bar. Since it's 10 a.m., there's not a lot of other people here. But I never let that stop me. I've been playing bar dice ever since I was 5 years old, when I spilled my sippy cup and my dad says, you shouldn't be drinking anymore, but you got some spilling skills. Fun fact.
So I think that's five. I'll give you a baker's dozen if you want, though. Go to the Sheep's Head tournament every year is in Wisconsin Dells, so go play some Sheep's Head over there.
And if I can embellish on what you said, I would take that kick up that play euchre a notch and say play euchre with Bob Euchre. I think that would be great.
I think that would be great if you can pull it off.
Yeah, I wrote it down already. And also go see Charlie Barron's live, of course, and buy the Midwest Survival Guide, which is the ultimate stocking stuffer. You're going to need a bigger stocking, probably, to paraphrase Jaws, but still, it's well worth it.
Yeah, and I tell you what, this book might be big, but that just means it's better for propping up wobbly tables, you know? So you got
exactly.
size
there
options.
You go. So what is the most valuable piece of advice you can share with us about surviving in the Midwest?
Oh, the most valuable piece, you know, we go into what you do when you hit a deer. And in the Midwest, it's not if you hit a deer, but it's when you hit a deer. Especially this time of year, they're running around all willy-nilly. So first things first, you got to assess the deer and see how much tenderizing of the meat you did. And you always have a buck knife in your car because, you know, that meat should not go to waste, honestly. You know, that's low carbon footprint meat right there. So
that's right.
And then just make sure you know how to field dress or ditch dress that deer and get back in your car. And you got supper for the winter right there.
There you go. Words of wisdom. Charlie Behrens, thank you for joining us. Congratulations on the Midwest Survival Guide and congratulations in advance on all of your future projects. I understand that one of them will be a new dance craze, the Manitowoc Minuet. I can't wait to learn it.
Oh, yes. That is, I haven't even gone public about that yet, but I'm glad you brought up that minuet. Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you for having me.
Charlie Behrens is the author of The Midwest Survival Guide, how we talk, love, work, drink, and eat everything with ranch. He's also the man behind the Manitowoc Minute. You can find out more about Charlie and surviving the Midwest at wpr.org/beta.
And I lucked out because my stand-up has always been an alternative, by my definition. Because what I think of as alternative comedy is... you tell the story of how you came up with the joke, and then you tell the punchline.
Wisconsin-born comedian Jackie Cation tells us how she makes people laugh. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Comedian Jackie Cation has been making people laugh for more than 35 years. Her albums have hit number one on Amazon and iTunes, and they've garnered more than 10 million listens on Spotify and Pandora. Jackie's latest special and companion album is titled Staycation. She is in fine form talking about a range of topics, including the rapture, ghosts, and her father, Elliot. Jackie now lives in LA, but she was born and raised in South Milwaukee and was the youngest of six kids. So it comes as no surprise that she took her own creative approach when it came time to make her stand-up debut as a heckler.
I went to University of Wisconsin, Madison, in the early 80s, and I had never seen stand-up before and clearly had never been out in public before, because during the show, I started heckling the comic, and there is genuinely nothing worse than a woman heckler. Even if you are a woman comic, because for some reason the audience is always on their side, and so everyone was on my side, and I was eventually yelled at by management, and literally the guy said, open mic is on Sundays, you have to shut up. And I came back 3 weeks later and did open mic.
Yeah, and it was Sam Kinison that you heckled, right?
Right, because the club was owned by his brother Bill Kinison. And Sam Kinison, of course, famously known for being super obnoxious, could not shut me up.
Do you remember what you heckled him about?
Yeah, it was just as lame as everyone's heckling. He had said that he was from Peoria, Illinois, and his timing was slightly off, and I was monumentally inebriated. And during that pause, I yelled, I'm sorry. And then that got a pretty big laugh just because my timing was better than his that very evening. Yeah. And then he tried to essentially mop up the floor with me. And then it didn't work because I wouldn't shut up anyway. And and so he just kept yelling at me and I just kept talking back. And so management had to approach me like three times.
Yeah, as you mentioned, though, obviously there were no grudges held by Sam Kinison, or at least not by his brother, Bill, because he invited you back to do comedy five nights a week, right? 3 weeks
right,
later.
Right. One of the great things about stand-up comedy is how they're willing, in the very beginning, to let and always let everyone try. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter who you are or how big of a mess you are, you can do open mic. Everyone yeah. can sign up.
Since you started out as a heckler, do you think that gives you kind of an advantage in terms of shutting up hecklers?
No, No, it sadly does not. It gives me no advantage, and it also is a bit of... And I've been doing stand-up since 1984, right? But I'm still slightly self-conscious when there is a heckler, where I'm just like, oh, well, this poor bastard doesn't know better. And much like myself, when I was a goofy dum-dum and just yelling stuff, so I have too much sympathy for them half of the time and too much rage the other half of the time. So I'm not actually very good with hecklers. I'm okay, but my favorite clubs kick them out for me, like to police the room.
Mm-hmm. Your special and album are called Staycation, and it's great. It's very funny and very fast-paced, and thank you for doing it. I especially enjoyed your jokes about your least favorite people. Who are your least favorite people?
My least favorite people are the End Times Rapture people.
But here's the thing. They want it to be the end times. There are people who wish it to be the end times right now because they want to get to the rapture. Here's the twist. They've decided that they're going to be horrible people to speed up the end times to get to the rapture. Let's unpack. First of all, not the end times, just terrible times. Try to help somebody. Second thing, the rapture. I don't know if you know anything about the rapture. They're not taking horrible people. Third thing you may not know about the rapture, not real, not real. Literally a parable to get you to not be a horrible person.
It's just sort of a circle of, wow, you aren't good at this at all. What is happening? And how about you don't be a horrible person and realize it isn't the end times, it's just crummy times, and you just try to help somebody in front of you, and then you can live your best Christian life.
You've been doing stand-up for more than 35 years. How do you think your comedic voice has evolved over the years?
When I first started doing stand-up, I talked about the same things I talk about now. I mean, I talk about the same thing that the same four things every comic talks about, which is sort of socio-political things on television, in the news, in interactions with humanity, my family life, and that's it. Like the future, the past, like the same four topics are discussed by absolutely every comic that gets on stage, and you have to make sure that you make it your own, and that's what's grown. You know, eventually you run out of material, so you have to kind of be vulnerable and really do a deep dive into whatever you're talking about, right?
How do you think stand-up comedy in general, not just, like, not your comedic voice, but stand-up comedy, the industry, how do you think it has changed over the past 35 years?
You know, when I first started, it was 84. There was this beginning of this observational kind of stand-up, you know, with sort of a pre-Seinfeld, but, you know, Leno and Letterman and all those guys with the setup punch. And there was a lot of that kind of stuff. And then in the late 90s, there was this advent of something called alternative comedy, which someone asked me to define it one time and in 1999. And I lucked out because my stand-up has always been an alternative by my definition. Because what I think of as alternative comedy is... you tell the story of how you came up with the joke, and then you tell the punchline. And that has always been, I tell the story regarding the funny thing that I'm about to do the punchline for.
Can you give me an example? Like in the Cation special, do you do that?
Well, there's so much stuff in the Staycation, because like all of that stuff about my dad is essentially just stories about my dad, with punchlines peppered throughout it of my observations and his observations and society's observations. Those are the punchlines, right? Like the story of him helping that guy with his hospital bill. So that is just a story of him helping a guy with his hospital bill.
So it's 5 to 5 on a Thursday, and my dad is like, starts in with the surgeon. He's like, yeah, you're never going to see this money. See, look at this guy. He can barely sit up. He just had surgery. And the surgeon's like, but I did the surgery. He's like, you're triple dipping. You're never going to see this money. Surgeon lasted almost an hour 15. Finally said, give me $200. Get the heck out of my office. So they write the check. And they're driving home, and my dad goes, so we're driving home, and I say to the old guy, let's stop at McDonald's and get a senior coffee. You could buy me a senior coffee. Get this, guy would not buy me a senior coffee. 59-cent senior coffee, guy wouldn't do it. And I was like, Dad, why would that guy want to spend another heartbeat with you? You just spent 5 hours telling anyone who would listen that he was a dead person. He's like, yeah, but I just saved him like 30 grand. And I was like, did you do it for the coffee? And he's like, yeah.
Your dad, Elliot, he's some of your funniest material in Cation is about him. Can you tell us a bit more about Elliot?
Well, Elliot Cation, he's my dad, and he's been in every album, right? Mm-hmm. So since the beginning, my timing comes from my dad, and my sense of humor comes from my stepmother. And the way that my father looks at life, you know, when you grow up, you think that everything's normal. You think this is how everybody lives. And then you turn 18, you get a job, you go to school, you go to college, you move away, and you meet other people with other parents and other families, and you really see from a different perspective of what might look different or odd or weird about your family. And so when that happened, I had just started doing stand-up comedy, and I learned that a lot of the lessons that my dad taught. So even my earliest stand-up comedy was about how my parents were different than other people's parents. But then people come up and go, my parents are like that too. And so there's commonality, but there's also the twist. Like one of my earliest jokes about my parents is how much I wanted a dog. Like my parents are very funny people. They aren't nice people. They're very funny people. I always wanted the dog. My parents hate animals. By the time I was 9, I wanted to be blind so that I could have a dog. And I made the mistake of telling my parents that, and they burst out laughing and said, well, we still wouldn't get you a dog. We'd get you a stick. You could name the stick. The thing is so that's them being weird from a parental and my father's sales technique.
So the last time I was home, I had dinner with my dad, and then I had breakfast with my dad. And at breakfast, I said, you hit on Maria Bamford using some weird skill. What was it? He was like, it's a sales technique, Jackie. It's called the post-close warm-up. I've been trying to teach all you kids how to do it since you were born. Is anyone listening to me? He said, I hit on the waitress. We went out to dinner last night. We hit on the waitress last night using the post-close warm-up. You were there. And I was like, I remember you hitting on the waitress, Dad. I also remember it not being successful. And he goes, it's not always going to be successful. It's a waitress. That is a hostage situation. She keeps going away. You can't build any kind of momentum, but you got to practice on someone.
And so, like, in the last album, I think it was, I did a joke about how my father was a lot like radiation. We never saw him, but he affected all of our lives. And so, and he's super smart, and he's very funny, but his perspective, it doesn't feel written, right? It doesn't feel classical. He doesn't feel like, you know, Mr. Cleaver, or, he's somewhere between, you know, the Godfather and Mr. Cleaver, right? So,
yeah,
the choices, he's very human. Part of my material is sort of accepting that humanity, while also when he makes bad life choices, I can recognize them as such and not repeat them.
Hmm. I read a recent interview in which you said that today's comedy fans re-listen to comedy. Can you talk about that? Why do you think they do that?
That's so, it's fascinating to me because, you know, back in the 70s, and to this day, you know, I have heard Jay Leno say that he doesn't have albums because he doesn't want to burn the material. But I don't think that that is as much an issue as it was back in the day. And the fact, it may stem, what do you think of this theory? And this is exactly what it is. It's a theory. The idea is that, you know, when VCRs were invented, and children started rewatching movies.
Mm-hmm.
And you would just replay Aladdin 1,000 times. I remember I used to do childcare. And I was like, why are we watching Homeward Bound again? And my 4-year-old niece would be like, because I love it. And you're like, okay. So to some extent, it's kind of soothing. You know where it's going. It's like I reread books.
Yeah.
And I reread books because I know how they'll end. I like the language. I like the characters. So I think with stand-up, maybe it's the same thing. Maybe people are like, I know how this joke is going to go. I love how it goes. I like listening to this person tell that joke. So maybe it's a little bit like that, the rewatching of movies. Prior to VCRs, we only really got that with music.
You host two podcasts. One of them is the Jackie and Laurie Show. You co-host it with former Beta guest, fellow comedian Laurie Kilmartin, and you occasionally talk about harassment and the poor treatment of women comedians. Have things gotten any better since the Me Too movement kicked off?
There's been great strides made in equality and injustice and all of these things. But because of those strides, the people who don't want those advances, right? The white supremacists and the misogynists and the people who want to control women and who fear homosexuality or whatever, they have become much more vocal and more in your face, right? There used to be a shame factor if you hated people. And now the hate, there's a lot less people that hate, but the people who do hate are much more vocal. And then the rest of us who sort of benefit passively from the system that's been in effect. In the United States, for example, the advantage of being a white person is not as overt as the things that don't happen to me. It's not like people are handing me 20s under the table for being a white woman, but I don't have to deal with a lot of things that black women have to deal with, or that black people in general have to deal with. So in the Me Too situation, I would say that it's making a lot of more decent people aware of their own advantages, but it's also making the bad guys go doubling down on it.
Mm. Yes, very well said. Thank you. Have you ever given any thought to just riffing off of the title of your new album and special, Staycation? Have you ever given any thought to Jackie Cation Vacations, where you travel the world with people on cruise ships and foreign countries, exotic climbs?
Ooh.
But I mean, we'd have to wait till COVID's over.
No, but I want that to be like a travel Food Network show called Vacation.
Yeah.
I think you just sold me an idea
Excellent.
That I should be pitching.
And, of course. Yeah. You've got to pitch it, yeah.
Right. The next album, if the Civil War hops up, we could call it Altercation.
Ooh, beautiful. You've got a whole media franchise here.
Right.
Way to go.
As long as there's plenty of things that end with the word Cation.
Yeah, and I'm sure there will be. Yeah. Jackie Cation, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Staycation. It was such a pleasure. So much fun to talk to you.
Thanks so much.
Jackie Cation is a stand-up comedian originally from South Milwaukee. You can find out more about Jackie and her latest special, Staycation, at WPR.org/beta.
There was something that was more interesting about Larry's life than just him doing stand-up. And they were smart enough to give him an incredible amount of freedom to let him do the show the way he wanted to do it.
Journalist James Andrew Miller on Larry David's HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm. James joins us in just a moment to talk about how home box office reinvented television. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Chances are, one of your favorite shows began with that sound. It's the sound of HBO's video logo. What came next was usually greatness. For nearly 50 years, HBO has been an innovator in television and media. James Andrew Miller has tried to capture, almost literally, all of that history in his new book, Tinderbox, HBO's Ruthless Pursuit of New Frontiers. James is an award-winning journalist who specializes in comprehensive oral histories, like ESPN and SNL. Could an oral history about WPR be next? I doubt it. But then again, I haven't received an interview request from Jim, so you never know. Jim conducted over 750 interviews to reveal the exclusive and comprehensive story of how Home Box Office went from frisky upstart to the epicenter of prestige television. That all turned into a doorstop of a book, clocking in at just under 1,000 pages. He joined us to share this history, or as much as we could cover, on how HBO created a revolutionary new content universe.
I think it fundamentally changed our relationship with TV and what TV could be in our lives. And first of all, we have to remember, we have to transport ourselves back to 1972. And so the idea that we could sit in our living room and watch a movie without commercials and without network censors blurting out language, nudity, and whatever else came along, I think was startling and revolutionary at the time. Second of all, it also, if you think about those qualities, HBO brought those things that you couldn't do at the network, violence, nudity, language, and other, to creative content that they were producing and buying. And I think that that fundamentally changed the nature. Look, you can't have a show like The Sopranos or Oz or so many other shows on network television. It also helped change the way in which storytelling was done on television. And then third, whether it was sports, documentaries, technology, and other things, I think that one of the things that happened with HBO was we were constantly being shown new ways to interact with television, new value propositions, if you will, that television had for us. And so I think it's an easy claim to make.
Mm-hmm, definitely. The origin story of HBO goes back to 1965 and a guy named Chuck Dolan. You have a quote from someone who told you that Chuck saw the future in ways that others did not. How was Chuck able to envision HBO?
Well, I think one of the things that he did was he decided that by being able to go outside the current architecture, outside the broadcast networks, outside of Washington, so to speak, and go directly to the home, there was a lot of things that you could do. He was particularly interested in sports and live sports.
And hello again, I'm Jim Lampley. We at HBO welcome you and the world of big time boxing back to Japan to test the theory that ticket buyers on foreign shores will purchase what Americans seem increasingly unwilling to shell out for. Apparent mismatches for Mike Tyson in defense of his heavyweight crown. With me again now is our HBO boxing.
It was huge. Look, there was a period of time when boxing and uncut movies were really the two foundations. You know, we tend to think of everything going on now with HBO and for the last 40 years, 49 years. There was a period of time when those were the real two selling propositions for HBO to the consumers. And they took boxing, which had been somewhat moribund and was relegated to Saturday afternoons on the networks, brought it to prime time. And also, just in time for like Mike Tyson and Thomas Hearns and Marvin Hagler and all these unbelievable boxers. And so I think boxing was a big engine for HBO's growth.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Sheila Nevins was the president of HBO Documentary Films, and she produced more than 1,000 docs for HBO. What impact did her contributions have?
Well, look, there's a powerful duality to Sheila Nevins running documentaries. She went very high with incredible investigations and documentaries about AIDS and Tourette's. I mean, the list is so long, including major ones like The Jinx and the Scientology documentary. But she also went low, and she was responsible for, you know, spearheading the late night, very, very sexual in nature documentary series that HBO did. And those things were incredibly popular.
What are some of your turn-ons?
Oh, I mean, Chinese food.
I like when she watches Saved by the Bell.
Maple syrup.
For me, silence usually turns me on a lot.
Andy Warhol.
Top Gun references.
I like rabbit food.
You talk to a lot of people, that's one of the first things that they remember about HBO was being able to turn on shows like Real Sex, Cat House, Taxi Cab Confessions, and see things that they hadn't seen before.
Chris Albrecht was very responsible for making comedy a big part of the HBO schedule. How did comedy content affect the growth of home box office?
Well, comedy winds up being another big driver for HBO's popularity. When you think about it, Doug, if you're a comedian in the 70s or the 80s, what's the prize? Well, the prize is being a guest on Johnny Carson's The Tonight Show. And you're going to get about 4.5 minutes to do your stand-up. You're going to be seen by millions and millions and millions of people. But you're also going to be at the mercy of network censors. So you're going to have to go through your routine. They're going to tell you what words you can say and what subjects you can talk about. And you can't mess around with it. I mean, if you were to violate one of their edicts, you're going to be kicked off television. There's no doubt about it. And along comes HBO. And HBO says, forget about 4.5 minutes. Forget about restrictions about language. Forget about restrictions about subjects. We're going to give you an hour. And we're going to give you your own comedy special.
Well, we have more ways to describe dirty words than we actually have dirty words. That seems a little strange to me. It seems to indicate that somebody was awfully interested in these words. They kept referring to them. They called them bad words, dirty, filthy, foul, vile, vulgar, coarse, in poor taste, unseemly, street talk, gutter talk, locker room language, barracks talk. Bawdy, naughty, saucy, raunchy, rude, crude, lewd, lascivious, indecent, profane, obscene, blue, off color, risque, suggestive, cursive.
George Carlin, I mean, he gets up there and he literally does the 7 words you can't say on television on television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, what could be better than that if you're a comedian? Robert Klein, Andrew Dice Clay, Robin Williams, Jerry Seinfeld. You go on and on and on, right through the entire gamut of major comedians at that time. And so HBO wound up being an incredible, important place for these comedians, and in turn, something that the audience couldn't get anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. How did HBO's early efforts at creating original programming go?
Well, they started off somewhat slow because they didn't want to really try and compete with the networks. And there were shows like Dream On, which was created by David Crane and Marta Kaufman, who went on to unbelievable success with Friends. There was First and Ten with O.J. Simpson. There was these other shows that came on. And then Larry Sanders' show and Oz were two big shows in HBO's early development, because both of them registered in a meaningful ways, in different ways. Larry Sanders, because everybody in Hollywood watched it. Everybody in Hollywood loved it.
Larry, we're off the air. This is real life now. Can I be honest with you?
Yeah.
I'm here for three good reasons. Last show, big ratings, movie coming out. Bim, bam, boom. Otherwise, I'll be sitting home watching Nightline, as usual.
And they were like, hey, wait a second, what's HBO doing? I want to work there. And wait a second, I hear that they have a lot of freedom that they give to their creators and their stars that the networks don't do. So that became a really great ambassador for what HBO wanted to do. Oz was fearless. It was incredibly violent, incredibly vulgar.
Your precious little dream, your Emerald City, is now a ghetto. You been there lately? Crap all over the floors, drugs everywhere, the lack of primary colors.
Well, that unit is no longer my responsibility.
Yeah, I got no problem with that. What we don't want is that new attitude over there to come wafting this way. They hear about what's going on, empowerment. They're gonna want the same thing here.
And you're suggesting what? That we make Unit B all white?
Yes.
Look, just start with the idea that it was a prison show. There's been a lot of medical shows on television, on network television, a lot of lawyer shows. Like, how many shows were set in a prison? Well, you don't really want to do that because it's such a dark, dangerous world. And HBO was instantly saying, we're going to go to places that the networks don't.
Yeah. We can't really talk about HBO without talking about David Chase's groundbreaking creation, The Sopranos. And I was surprised to learn that he didn't come up with the idea for the show. How did The Sopranos change the HBO universe?
I assume you're talking about the very idea of the show, right? And
that's the premise, you know, yeah.
There's a unsung hero named Lloyd Braun, who was working with David at the time when he had an overall deal at Brillstein Gray. And David was coming up with a bunch of ideas, and none of them were really registering. And Lloyd one day was walking him to the elevator and said, you know, what if there was something about, like, The Godfather was one of my favorite movies and such a great movie. And what if there was something that was like, for now, you know, updated version of what The Godfather was? And David says, well, you know, I'm Italian. And it just took off from there. But I think it shows what I like doing is kind of peeking behind the curtain of ideas and shows and stars' lives and talk about those things that, you know, we didn't know before and how they wound up having such a huge effect on, you know, what we're able to see.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of HBO's most groundbreaking series is Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm. Even by HBO standards, I would say it's groundbreaking. How was Curb Your Enthusiasm developed?
Well, it originally started as a mockumentary that Larry David did basically about his post-Seinfeld life and about returning to stand-up. And so it was almost like a reality show. He had a crew following him. And one of the things that happened was after it was shot, Chris Albrecht and Larry and Carolyn Strauss talked about the fact that there was something that was more interesting about Larry's life than just him doing stand-up. And they were smart enough to give him an incredible amount of freedom to let him do the show the way he wanted to do it. And because of that singular decision, that decision to give him endless amounts of rope and freedom, the show was still on more than 20 years later.
She knew what she was doing.
Okay.
She was born to it.
Okay.
She was great.
All right. Okay. I'm sorry. This dinner's not going very well.
Sorry.
And the reason it's not going well is because the wrong people are in the middle.
What?
Yeah. You can't handle the middle. You're not a middler.
Andy, really? Not everybody has the personality for the middle.
It's very presumptuous of you to even be sitting here.
Freddie happens to be a great middle. I know that. I'd like Freddie and Cassie to switch, and I'd like Andy and Larry.
But your house.
I
have told these stories before and got laughs.
Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
Anyway, let me just finish the story.
No
more boat.
No.
Let's look at the other side of the coin. HBO's biggest mistakes over the years. What are they?
Well, look, first of all, let's start with the obvious proviso that nobody bets a thousand. There are four shows that easily come to mind: House of Cards, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and The Crown. Now, it could easily be argued, and I detail it in the book, that all four of those shows could have wound up on HBO. The reasons why they didn't are different, but I think that they're illustrative in a couple ways. One was, in the case of House of Cards, HBO was thinking about doing it, wanted to do it, and then all of a sudden, Netflix is there, and HBO is going to do a pilot. Netflix gives them two full seasons. Well, that's one of those clarifying moments where you realize the business has changed, and HBO doesn't enjoy the advantages that it used to have. Look, can you imagine a world where those four shows are on HBO? That's going to be incredibly detrimental to both AMC and Netflix without those shows. So there were serious consequences.
Mm-hmm. HBO created the concept of streaming, and now it faces competition from other streaming services like Netflix, Disney Plus, and Hulu. How do you think the future of home box office will play out?
Right. Well, that's, Don, you just asked the million-dollar question. I think we're sitting here at the end of 2021, and we're looking at an industry that is in, I wouldn't say chaos, but it's been disrupted so much, and there are so many players trying to adapt and survive and grow that it's unclear how HBO positions itself. I think this is probably one of the most uncertain times for HBO. And I'm not sure that the kind of success that they've had over the past 49 years is guaranteed to them for the future.
James Andrew Miller, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Tinderbox. It's a great book.
Thank you so much for having me.
James Andrew Miller is the author of Tinderbox, HBO's ruthless pursuit of new frontiers. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Charlie Behrens, Jackie Cation, and James Andrew Miller. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for Wisconsin Public Radio and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Some people make fun of me for the facial hair, but you know, you wake up at 3 a.m., go to bed at midnight for like 12 days straight, you'll get some whiskers too.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I am so relatable.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Kind of hurts a little. Thank you. Thank you. And sorry again to ask. Tell your folks I said
okay,
hey.
Okay, we'll do it. All right. All right. Take care now.